The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Eugene G. Doherty presiding.
Good morning. Court is calling case number 424-0929, People versus Clayton Bell. I'd ask counsel for the appellant to please state your name for the record.
Michael Dubay. Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. And counsel for the appellee.
John Barrett. Good morning, Your Honors.
All right, good morning. Mr. Dubay, you may proceed.
Thank you. Please the court, Your Honors, co-count our counsel. The case that's before the court has multiple reasons why the judgment of the trial court should be reversed. I've got seven reasons I've listed in my brief. I'll try to cover all those today, but I'll focus on just a few of the main ones. I'm open to any questions the court may have regarding either my argument or the brief today. The first one I want to address is that the trial court failed to consider the youth-based sentencing factors in this case. Mr. Bell, at the time of the offense, was 16 years old, and he was sentenced when he was 18 years old. But the factors should be going back to when the offense occurred at his age, which was 16. The trial court in this case only considered aggravating factors in the mitigation and aggravation according to the what I called the adult standard. He did not address the standards that are required for the youth-based sentencing factors under 730 ILCS 5-5 4-5.105. In that case, there's multiple factors that need to be taken into consideration, and not only do they need to be considered, they need to be articulated by the court. And even in the court's order, after my motion to reconsider, the court merely said that he had considered these, but he did not articulate them as he was required to do so. Had he considered these factors, he would have looked at the different things such as the age of the impetuosity, the level of maturity at the time of the offense, whether the person was subjected to outside pressures, including peer pressure, family pressure, or negative influences. It's clear in this case that, and it kind of coincides with the ineffective assistance of counsel, because there was an audio tape, or actually a videotape of 8 seconds in this case right before the crash that was played at sentencing. And Attorney Sullivan, the counsel at the time for Mr. Bell, didn't present any mitigation. He didn't present any argument as to the context of that video. He simply let the thing be played in its raw form, and it was very negative to Mr. Bell. Had the court considered the youth-based factors, which he was supposed to do under Morris, these could have been presented as Elena was one of the passengers in this vehicle, and she's obviously survived the accident. She gave an account of what had taken place prior to the accident, what had taken place on the video, and stating that there was pressure. All the people in the vehicle, there was three other passengers in the vehicle besides Mia, who had passed away as a result of this accident. What took place was that if you just watch the raw video, they appear to be begging him to stop, slow down. They're afraid of dying. But Elena put that into context that this was all a joke. That's why Mia, or Reese, her brother, was videotaping the entire incident. And the court didn't consider any of this. He simply took into consideration the fact that Mr. Bell didn't have any prior criminal experience. And so that was the only factor in mitigation, he said. Factors in mitigation, no prior offenses. Factors in aggravation needs to be done to, he needs a jail sentence to protect the public. And that's basically it. So it was very clear. If you listen to or you read the transcript from the sentencing, the trial court didn't consider at all the youth-based sentencing factors, even though he says that he did in his order. It's not articulated at all. He simply went right to sentencing factors and mitigation, aggravation. That was it. Didn't articulate anything about that on the record, which is required, which leads then into And I can discuss that further if you want. I just wanted to make sure we cover all the points here. That it gets into the next one that the court erred in applying the statutory factors in mitigation and aggravation, because again, he didn't consider anything, even if he would have considered the factors in aggravation that are there. There are other factors that would have played in besides the one that the court said. The second one being the defendant did not contemplate his criminal conduct would cause or threaten serious physical harm to another. The defendant acted under strong provocation. He was provoked by the others to do this. Elena says that they were there saying, catch air, go faster. They'd all been on this hill before. This was something that was, it's really a nuisance. It's a public nuisance, this hill that should have been dealt with before. There's been many accidents there, but these kids do this all the time. And that the provocation wasn't considered. The defendant was the factor in here that the defendant would be compensated, or the survivors would be compensated, that there was insurance here, there were injuries, and there was insurance paid out in this case. The defendant's criminal conduct was a result of circumstances unlikely to reoccur. This is not something that's going to reoccur, but that wasn't considered by the court. The character and attitude of the defendant indicate that he is unlikely to commit another crime. This was a situation that, as a youngster, 16 years old, they're at a party, they're making bad choices. Elena stated that all of them were drinking that night. None of them should have been involved in this situation, but they all played a part. They all, and when Elena stated that when Reese and my client got ready to leave, it was just going to be the two of them. But Mia, the sister, asked that they could go along with them. And so, again, that plays into the part that this wasn't contemplated. This wasn't something that was thought out by him. It wasn't something that he intended to have happen. He didn't even want to drive, but they kept asking him, and finally he gave in to drive. So that all plays in. The court didn't consider any of these other factors and just the normal factors in mitigation. So I believe the court erred in that part too. The court erred when it determined that Mr. Bell was incapable of rehabilitation. He's 16 years old. And the court made a determination based off one failed test for marijuana. And when asked about this, Attorney Sullivan didn't have any response because he hadn't properly investigated this. He didn't mitigate this at all. Had he done so, he would have had an argument for the court to say, well, Mr. Bell is still under stress. And maybe he was coping with stress by smoking marijuana, because on two instances, as I found out and had his coach testify to, that in the spring and the fall, Mia's aunt had approached Mr. Bell at these meets and made comments like, I didn't know they let killers participate in track or cross country. And she was harassing him to the point that the coach had her removed from Limestone. She was not allowed to attend any more of these events because of her actions. Had Mr. Sullivan investigated this at all and talked to his coach, he would have discovered this, and he would have had at least an argument for the court to say, well, this is why he might have done this. But the trial court simply took it as being, well, you're under this scrutiny, and because you've had this one positive test, are you kidding me? So he took that as to say he is not possible for being rehabilitated, which is ridiculous because, as every study has pointed out, that juveniles, their brains are still developing. They are the most likely to be rehabilitated because of their youth, the development of the brain, the development of everything about them is going on. They are the most likely to be, but the court just took that as, well, you're not eligible for rehabilitation, and then gave him a 14-year sentence because of it. The next thing I talked about, and this is a big one here, is that during the sentencing, the trial court allowed unauthorized representatives of Mia's group to make victim impact statements. Now, I had Attorney Sullivan on the stand. I asked him if he was familiar with the statute. And he said that he was with the act. And I said, then why did you allow these? Why didn't you object? Well, he didn't want to offend anybody. And he acted like the court had discretion to allow other people to make statements. Even the trial court in our discussions made the statement that he thought he had discretion to let non-representatives make statements, which is completely wrong. Larson points out, and Larson even goes into listing all of the people that, I just lost my light here, all the people that are not allowed to make statements, including the aunt and all of these people who made statements, her best friend, even what was going to be her mother, Deborah's future husband. He was not allowed to make a statement, but he made one anyway. And in making these statements, Mr. Manning and Deborah, the mother, made false statements. They made statements that my client was driving the homecoming parade float at the homecoming parade, which, again, had Mr. Sullivan done any kind of research on this and investigated this at all, he would have found out that the track and cross country coach had borrowed Mr. Bell's grandfather's truck and he was driving. He even wrote a letter, which I've added in there, that he was driving the truck. Clayton was on the float and he was asked to be there because he's an athlete. He wasn't trying to
What
show up.
about the trial court's comment that he would have found that to be more problematic, to be riding on the float?
I find that to be, if you look at the entire transcript of the sentencing hearing and how he was offended by that, to come back and say afterwards, well, I'd have been more offended by this. I think that's just trying to clean it up. I don't think that's true at all because he made multiple comments in the sentencing hearing about, oh, I bet you were really upset when you were up there with all your friends. You were a real downer when you're on the float or driving the float for the homecoming. I don't think I think it's disingenuous. I don't think that that was an accurate statement. I think that he displayed his displeasure in that and those statements being false. They were proven to be false. There's a picture of Clayton, which I've also included in the letter, on the float. And then Deborah made a comment that Clayton refused to attend the assembly that she was speaking at regarding underage drinking and the effects of that. And the counselor who I brought in made it very clear that it was him. He had approached Clayton and asked him not to attend because he didn't want, first of all, Deborah to feel under pressure. He didn't want anything awkward in this, so he asked him not to attend the assembly. So there's two situations there where unauthorized people were allowed to make statements. Attorney Sullivan didn't properly investigate this to provide the correct mitigation, but the court became biased. Now it kind of all coincides together. But in this case, the court had no ability to allow non-representatives to enter and make statements in this case. They could have put their letters in, but they can't make the statements. And so I think that was a big part of this and the bias that came from this. And really, it put Clayton in a very bad position. And Attorney Sullivan knew about this. And the case law talks about that even if nobody objects, the Supreme Court has said that the courts need to follow the statute. And it's clear that the trial court did not follow the statute. And that was an error that resulted in a violation of Mr. Bell's rights. And it should cause for this to come back. Just that alone should come back for resentencing. We also get into the bias of the court. Now, it's very clear if you read through the entire transcript how the court became biased, and he just got more and more angry and biased towards Mr. Bell as this sentencing hearing went along. And he talked about in here about how he was personally touched by that video. And I don't know, it just jumps out at you when you read that, but he says, that really bothered me. I'm not just a judge, I'm a person. And you're going to find out how much it bothered me in a few minutes. That's when he maxed him out on the sentence of 14 years. So it's very clear that he is bothered by this as a person. He's allowing his own feelings to come in, not taking it from a judicial standpoint of not being biased and just looking at the facts. He
Well, bias is a very powerful word. It is more equivalent to prejudgment than to judgment. So there's nothing in the record, and I don't think you've made a suggestion that there was a prejudgment made. It's just this was the court's reaction to the evidence, which seems more like judgment than prejudgment.
And I agree with it, Your Honor. He was not, I don't think he was biased coming in. I think that because of the situation, and it was very telling. If you've watched that video and only thing you have is the raw video and what you hear without the context that Elena could have provided, it's very bad. It's very damaging. And I could see how a judge or any person could look at that and all of a sudden, and when I say bias, it's because it does change you from an open mind and looking at this to all of a sudden you have this human effect where, oh my gosh, that could be my child. And if somebody was begging for somebody to stop and or to slow down, I don't want to die as a person. And that's where the judge really came into this. He brought it as a personal aspect. He didn't look at it from a judicial standpoint and say, okay, looking at this video, there's this and this. But he took it as a personal standpoint, and that's where I think it changes. And I think the case law really points that out when you
But
go.
if his impression was both accurate and complete, that wouldn't be an inappropriate concern for the judge to have, would it?
I think it is when he expresses to them that as a person, this bothered me because I'm not just a judge, I'm a person, and you're going to find out exactly how much it bothered me. Now he's saying, as a person, you're going to find out how much it bothered me in just a minute. So he took it from the context of a judicial standpoint of I'm going to apply this to the statute. I'm going to show you what it means to me personally, and I'm going to make you pay for it. And I think that's where it crosses over and becomes the problem. And that's where I put in the different cases that I brought into this, it really shows. And they use the word bias because of that. And I don't think that in theirs they say that a person comes in biased against somebody, but because of the actions that took place in the hearing, they can become biased because of that. And no way am I insinuating that the trial court is biased in any universal way in this case. It happened because of the false accusations and everything that built up into that. That would be my point there. And I think, and it kind of goes into the excessive sentence. I think the trial court erred when it issued a 14-year sentence. It maxed out the sentence in this case. This case actually allows for probation in extraordinary circumstances. So it is probationable, but it also carries a maximum of 14 years at 85%. Mr. Bell had no record, none whatsoever. This is a nonviolent case. He did not intend for this to happen, so it's not intentional. And his youth, everything that goes into this, there's it's I do this every day. I don't see sentences like this. I don't see somebody getting maxed out in a case like this on a first offense. In there were this case, because of everything in here, it did have extraordinary circumstances. It should have carried at least a strong consideration for probation. But that was never considered, which is going to be the next part because of Mr. Sullivan's ineffective assistance of counsel, because the judge didn't know all of these things that should have been brought in, that should have been there, that were right there. He had a year to mitigate this. Clayton was still in school. He could have went and found out all of these things. I did it. It didn't take me a year. I did it very quickly. Mr. Sullivan didn't do it at all, because he didn't want to offend anybody. He also had a connection to Mr. Manning, which he hid from Kristen Bell when she hired him. He tried to say that I didn't learn about Mr. Manning being involved in this case until right before sentencing. Kristen, Clayton's mother, questioned him at the start before she hired him because she didn't want this to happen where somebody would sabotage Clayton's defense, who'd work for him. And it's very clear here that there was a connection. Mr. Manning's brother is his financial advisor. Mr. Manning works for a firm that Mr. Sullivan does business with. And he even told Kristen he was going to float him some business to see where his mind was at in this case. So he had, there's a conflict here with him. But he wasn't honest about the fact that he had met or had contact with Mr. Manning. But He didn't do anything. He said that he tried to contact Elena about the accident, about the video, but he never did. I asked Elena, I had her on the stand. She gave me an affidavit. At no point did he ever reach out to her. And at the end of Mr. Sullivan's testimony, I pressed him on it again. He had said twice during his testimony that he did try to contact her, but at the end of his testimony, I said, "And you didn't even try to contact her, did you?" And he said, "No." So he conflicts himself again in this. All he had to do was talk to the people at the school, talk to his coach. I'm sorry, my time up, Your Honor.
It is.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Barrett.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. John Barrett representing the people of the state of Illinois. The 14-year sentence imposed by the trial court in this case was not an abuse of discretion. It was a measured response to an act of profound recklessness that stole the life of 15-year-old Mia Dusick. The defendant now asks this court to reweigh the evidence and substitute its judgment for that of the trial court, something that it cannot do. He raises seven issues on appeal, but each one fails upon careful review of the record. The case involves not only the tragic loss of young Mia Dusek, but a pattern of poor judgment that continued even after that loss.
Mr. Barrett,
Now,
is there
yes.
anything in the record of the sentencing hearing to suggest that the trial court considered or was even made aware of the juvenile sentencing factors?
The trial court addressed this at the motion to reconsider
Right,
sentence,
right. So let's,
where
do you agree there's nothing in that transcript that indicates that the court considered the juvenile factors?
Correct, Your Honor. At the
All right.
original proceeding, no.
Right. And so later he says he did. But didn't the court affirmatively tell us which factors, which mitigating factors it was considering at the original hearing? It just said the no criminal activity, that's it for statutory factors and mitigation. I know what he said at the motion to reconsider. But I don't know how those two are compatible.
Can you hear me?
Ken, now you froze for a
Sorry, it
second.
looked like there was a glitch. The court is not obligated to weigh a mitigating factor less so than an aggravating factor, especially where the aggravating factor
But you
Also,
have to consider it.
These are not
that
just mitigating factors. These are mitigating factors that come up in serious crimes involving juveniles or emerging young adults.
Correct.
And there's plenty of case law that suggests you need to articulate what's going on. I'm sorry, Justice Doherty, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I think we're going to the same place.
Sure. Yes. And the court was, it acknowledged that it did not state sufficiently, or it did not state sufficiently artfully on the record that it had considered those factors, but it affirmed that it had considered the factors. But
But
it's
that's, he told us the opposite at the hearing. He told us that there's only the one factor. And one of the factors is age.
correct, and lack of criminal history.
Right. Well, not just lack of criminal history. We know he considered that. The person's age, that we know beyond a doubt this is a young person, right?
Correct.
And no mention's made of that.
Well, a person's age does not prevent a person from being even sentenced as an adult, given the circumstances of an offense. Here, the trial court looked at these as very aggravating, more so than even considering age as a mitigating factor.
I know, but we're talking about a scale, right? Aggravating on one side, mitigating on the other. And he's saying there are none. You're not talking about the weight here. He said there are no mitigating factors. Isn't that error in black and white when he said that?
Well, the court is discussing the evidence weighing in favor of the factors. So this is not sufficiently artful. He acknowledged that may have not been sufficiently artful, but he affirmed that he had considered the factors and that these aggravating factors and aggravating elements superseded those.
What weight do we know that he put on the defendant's age? Let's put aside level of maturity, which might be fairly apparent, but age is undisputable. I have no idea how much weight he put on the defendant's age.
Well, if we look at a person's age, impetuosity, and level of maturity, and just on its own objectively, here, that would be going towards a defendant being impressionable, being influenced by peer pressure. And if you look at the video, counsel is stressing what happened at the beginning of the video. But many, many miles later, after the circumstances had changed in that car and there was sheer terror going on, defendant was not being influenced by, coaxing to go faster or catch air at that point. He was traveling over 80 miles per hour against the cries and the shrieks of the people in the car. I've watched that video. It absolutely is chilling to watch. But so this is not a peer pressure related event. This
Okay,
is not.
that's a different factor. My question was, do we know how the court weighed the defendant's age or level of maturity?
We know that it considered it. The court affirmed that it considered it. We look at
At
the,
reconsideration,
we, yes.
even though at sentencing, he said there were no other factors.
The court weighed the evidence. It didn't say that age wasn't a mitigating factor, but it didn't put
Well,
weight
I
to
don't
it.
know. When
It
you
didn't
say
put
there's
weight.
one factor and no others, and he doesn't say age, how are we supposed to read that as concluding that he considered age?
Well, we have to look at the totality of the circumstances and the totality of what was considered. Here we have a 16-year-old kid who made an adult choice and was sentenced
That
on
is
a claim.
the choice in every case involving a minor.
Correct.
The dumb kid that picks up a gun. But those factors are always articulated in sentencing in every criminal case that comes before us. Simply because this is traffic doesn't mean it's not criminal. I mean, we've got a decade of case law regarding the difficulty that judges have in applying these youth factors. And here's one where, as far as we know, other than the judge saying later, "Oh yeah, I considered those," he didn't consider any of them.
And I
It's
think
more
that's
than
the
just age, it's all the things that go with age.
point, counsel, to allude to the fact that he considered the youth-based sentencing factors. At a minimum, he should have set forth the issue with regards to age, and he does not do that until later on. So when he says there's no other factors, as Justice Doherty has pointed out, how are we knowing that at a minimum age should have been discussed and it wasn't, that he considered these? I think that's more about whether he even considered the factors versus the weight.
I think you have to look at the clarification the court made at the motion to reconsider sentence. And the court went through and focused on key pieces of evidence that it felt overwhelmed some of those other mitigating factors. So the court did clarify and it did expand that analysis, but it wasn't sufficiently artful, as it said, at the original sentencing hearing.
Now, I know there's a question of considering, and the court might find that the factor doesn't apply in a given case, and I
Correct.
understand. But what about the level of planning by the defendant before the offense? Is there some issue here that the defendant planned this?
Well, the defendant in the PSI, if we look at the PSI, he admitted that he drank six drinks prior to the accident. And he had been smoking marijuana, admittedly, in the PSI. So, the courts are clear on.
Okay,
The
but
drunk
the
driving involves
language
the
is
conscious choice to sip and sip and sip, and that defendant was doing that.
the language is the planning of the offense.
Right. Not the offense itself, no. The offense
Right.
itself, no.
So that's another factor that, without a doubt, is present in this case. And we don't know what weight the trial court put on it, if any.
Right. We have what we have is the court addressing specific factors that it considered or that it felt weighed out in favor of the max sentence here. So the court didn't go through and articulate each separate factor in a formulaic way, and I don't even think the statute does require that. It does require that the factors are considered. If you look at the statute, it says the court must consider these, and the court did affirm that it had considered those factors, and then it stressed the other factors and talked. Now I want to get to some of the other arguments that counsel was making. Regarding judicial bias, the judicial bias argument I think doesn't really have much traction because the trial court here, unlike the cases cited by defense counsel, wasn't making comments, personally disparaging comments about the racial identity of this defendant. Or animosity in that way. The court's focus was on the evidence, the circumstances of the offense, and the evidence. And it acknowledged that it was human, sure. And a court is human, but as a human being who is a judge, the judge made decisions based on appropriate consideration. So I don't think based on the
So, unless it's at my end, I believe that Mr. Barrett is frozen.
Yes.
I cannot hear Mr. Barrett as well.
I can't either.
Well, if we get him back, we'll add a little time to the end.
I was saying that Attorney Sullivan at the sentencing hearing, he began the argument noting that he was not intending in any way to denigrate the memory of Mia. So there is a very, very strong strategic choice in avoiding any arguments that would be to denigrate her memory or victim blame. And then he goes into stressing how exceptionally remorseful the defendant was.
That's a very broad use of the phrase victim blaming. Is it victim blaming to want to put in a more complete video?
Well, so the counsel strategically avoided putting forth evidence that he felt would be disadvantageous to his client who was pleading guilty. By putting forth evidence of the victim many, many, many miles before the actual accident occurred, which is not even connected to it. The circumstances then were not the circumstances at the time of the crash.
All fair argument, but it does seem like you can put in and ask that a complete video be put in without being critical in any way of the victim.
Yeah, the focus of counsel was strategic. He affirmed that it
What's the
was strategic.
strategy in allowing statutorily inadmissible victims' impact statements? What's the strategy there?
Now, again, there, defendant uses a case, People v. Larson, where it was just a parade of unconnected victims. Here you had people who actually did have very close connections with the victim, and it was just a select
Statutorily, statutorily ineligible. Do you agree
few.
with that?
Right. And the statute is not a sword for defendants to defeat their sentences or to overturn their convictions. The statute itself says that it is a shield to protect victims. It is not intended to be used as a sword for defendants to overcome their sentences or their convictions. And the Illinois Supreme Court has also said that. So that's not a permissible request, especially here where we have multiple victims who were, this wasn't a parade. It wasn't a parade. If they didn't meet the statutory definition, it's the requested relief isn't available under the statute, pure and simple.
How is it
Now,
enforced then?
it's enforced for the victim's rights. That's the enforcement mechanism is for the victims to ensure that they have voice, that they can get up and make statements. If there is extraneous evidence or things outside of that that would impact the sentencing hearing, there are other constitutional arguments that could potentially be made. But just the fact of certain of these victims making statements, that's not a cause for a defendant to reverse the conviction or the sentence under the statute. Getting back into the ineffective assistance of counsel, the defense counsel did highlight the defendant's age, that he was 16 at the time of the offense. He did highlight that. He also highlighted that defendant pled guilty to spare the victim's families from having to endure a trial. And counsel did go through the statutory factors. He argued that defendant didn't contemplate that his conduct would cause serious harm. That was mentioned at the hearing. We have 14 pages of argument at the sentencing hearing on the part of counsel. He talked about no prior criminal history, that the conduct resulted from circumstances unlikely to recur. If you go through the record, these were all mentioned by counsel. He was very specific and he was very thorough in his arguments.
Of course, he forgot to mention any of the youth considerations other than the age. And as a matter of fact, didn't he say something like he thought the judge would do it?
He mentioned that those were mandatory considerations, that the court was obligated to consider those in the
Well, the
statute.
court's obligated to consider all the mitigating factors that are
Correct.
in the
Correct.
statute, except when he makes his argument, he doesn't make any reference to these youth factors.
So,
I mean, if it's the court's job, can defense counsel just sit down and say, well, it's the court's job to consider all this stuff. I don't really have to say anything.
and the, well, the defense counsel specifically mentioned his age. He did mention age. He did mention that he was taking responsibility. He all of these things that play into the actual specific things the defendant was doing were related to age. So, and he affirmed that he believed that the statute itself was considered by the trial court, and that the trial court would consider that. And then also, defense counsel did argue for exceptional circumstances, and giving his client probation. He mentioned that, and he also suggested impact incarceration and boot camp sentence. So at the sentencing hearing, he was, putting forth these alternative arrangements outside of a lengthy prison sentence. We may have our disagreements with this, certain specific ways that defense counsel argued, but if we look at the totality of how the counsel was making these arguments, the totality of it, it was certainly he was functioning as counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. Ineffective assistance claims require showing that counsel was just not functioning as the counsel contemplated by the Sixth Amendment. And here we don't have that. We have a 14-page sentencing argument where he goes through a litany of factors, and he definitely addressed many that are on point with the youth statute. And I want to make sure I address any other questions the court has before closing here.
Do you think that perhaps he was remiss in not finding out about the fact that the defendant was not driving the homecoming float and did not refuse to attend the presentation made by the victim's mother? particularly in fact that a counselor said, you know, that could be disruptive or awkward. I don't think you should go. And so you've got a youthful high school student, perhaps following the direction of a counselor. And regarding the driving the homecoming float, I think it's being on the homecoming float and actually driving it seems to be different and could have a different effect on the judge. Those are
Right.
two things that weighed, that appeared to me weighed into the idea that he's walking around with his head held high and he's smug and he's happily going on engaging in these other activities, and somehow he ought to be penalized for that.
Well, we know at the sentencing hearing, or the motion to reconsider sentence, that the trial court did comment on those statements that were made by the victims, or the victim impact statements regarding defendant driving the float and then that assembly. And the trial court indicated that that wouldn't have made any difference whether or not defendant had been driving the float or that he was riding on the float. It wouldn't have made any difference.
Does
Well,
it
that
make
would
any
have made sense.
difference about the float? I don't think he said anything about the assembly or presentation.
Well, in the summation part of or in the conclusion part of the argument, if the court found that it had considered the evidence, the actual evidence, it wasn't considering these other extraneous factors that were brought up in by defense counsel. One other thing, I think it's important to look at the timeline here. So we have in February of 22, that's the date of the fatal crash. The court ordered pretrial release conditions in May, on May 11th of 22. The homecoming float was the fall, was fall of 2022, and by that time, defendant was continuing to hang out with kids who were still using alcohol and drugs. He himself tested positive for cannabis in November of 22. So from between February and November, the defendant was still hanging out and using drugs. We know that. We know the trial court was concerned about that. Was it, should it have been? Yes, this was an alcohol
What did
related.
the trial court know about the drinking?
Yeah, and then also in the PSI, defendant acknowledged that he had been smoking marijuana that night as
I
well.
asked about drinking.
Yes.
How do we know that he continued to hang out with his friends and drink?
In the PSI,
He
it talked
indicated
about
that.
his associates. It indicated that he was continuing to associate. Yes. And no rehabilitative efforts. So the trial court was confronted with a defendant who had all this time to pursue rehabilitation and did not do so, and posed a risk to the community. Defendant in the pretrial release conditions, he was not permitted to possess or consume any alcohol or illegal drugs. He was a moderate risk. The uniform report, alcohol and drug uniform report, classified him as a moderate risk. He admitted to enjoying risk-taking behavior, and probation identified that alcohol and substance abuse treatment was highly recommended for this defendant, and defendant did not pursue those things. So the trial court was faced with a defendant who hadn't learned his lesson. And then even after he tested positive for cannabis in November, he was ultimately sentenced the following June. And between the November and June, there was still no pursuit. So this was just a defendant who had dug his heels in and wasn't pursuing any kind of rehabilitation. So the court was admittedly exasperated by that.
Why don't you wrap up, counsel?
All right, I'm sorry. I didn't mean
No
to go
problem.
so much over, but I think that takes care of everything I had. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dubed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, counsel is giving more argument regarding Mr. Bell and the negative things about him than the prosecutor did at sentencing. He's bringing up things that weren't brought up at sentencing about Mr. Bell continuing he alleging to drink and hang out with his friends that were drinking. That was even brought up by the prosecutor or the probation at sentencing. I will address the fact under Larson, he says that there's no remedy. And it's only to protect victims. Larson specifically says that the violation of The act can deprive a defendant of fair sentencing hearing and thus violate his or her right to due process. So to say that there is no remedy under the statute or under Larson for a defendant is ridiculous. It says it right there. That's why there's case law on that. That's why you have to follow the statute, because you don't want to deprive somebody of a fair sentencing and violate their due process rights. As far as the court's question regarding Attorney Sullivan, and he simply relied on the court. He even said it, that he was relying on the court to go to the Juvenile Sentencing Act. I asked him, he was asked if it was his job as an effective attorney to make sure that you put everything in front of a judge for mitigation in your client's case, and he replied, yes. He was then asked, but you didn't do that, did you? To which he replied, I didn't argue these, if that's what you're saying. He didn't make all these arguments that counsel's talking about. He got into this 14 pages as him talking to the judge asking questions about, well, did your client do these things yet? And so Mr. Sullivan didn't present anything. He was tiptoeing around the whole time because he didn't want to offend anybody. And he was afraid that somehow that would turn the court off or offend somebody there, which goes back to his association with Manning. And that Manning is an attorney. There, his dad was a judge. Mr. Sullivan's father was a judge. They all hung out on holidays growing up. And he just didn't want to offend anybody here, so he didn't do anything. He even talks about in there for this the statement allocution, he didn't even help him write that. He said he showed up and got with Mr. Bell 10 minutes before the hearing and just basically had Mr. Bell do his own statement and allocution, which is why when the judge started to question him on it, he didn't know what to say. He's a young kid, never been in this situation before. And here he is now having to explain to a judge how remorseful he is. And then a judge kind of going after him, saying, I don't believe you. But that's on Mr. Sullivan. That's his job. Even for an adult who's been in the process before, you spend time with them on a statement allocution, especially in a child who doesn't have any experience in this. You show up 10 minutes before and expect to go over a statement allocution with him. He's been out of custody. He's had all this time. He just didn't do it, much like he didn't do anything else. And counsel keeps mentioning this video, like there was miles before this. This is an 8-second video of the crash. There are no miles before.
I think the point is that where the character of the conversation on the video is different is miles before that 8 second clip.
Which is why I had Elena do an affidavit about everything that took place, how she got to the party, how everybody was there at the party, how everybody was drinking, what all took place. It's spelled out explicitly in my motion when I had her on the stand and in her affidavit to give the court an idea. And that's what should have been done. This isn't victim blaming. This is a situation where you have to articulate to the court why this video isn't what it says, why it's not this raw video. And Elena was able to articulate that. And I asked him, how is he going to bring this out if he didn't talk to these people? He said, through Mr. Bell. And I said, so you think the judge is going to believe Mr. Bell? Isn't it a self-serving statement? He said, well, probably. So he didn't do anything. He was entirely ineffective in this case. He didn't do anything to try to help mitigate this case. He took the money, he showed up, and that was it. He could have done much, much more. As far as the rehabilitation part of this, did he direct Mr. Bell to go do these things as he was directed? Counsel's trying to act like Mr. Bell is violating all kinds of rules. He wasn't. He had one violation for marijuana. That was it, which is explainable, as I've already indicated in this case. So, in summing up, Your Honor, I think that the case shows in the totality of everything that took place that the court didn't apply the correct statutes in this case. Mr. Bill, Sullivan was ineffective. We would ask you to grant our motion, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, thank you. The court will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision in due course, and we now stand in recess.